Yes, but I can't, Will. Not now. I have to make it. I'm confused. I don't under... I've been dying my whole life. Every birthday, we celebrated like it was my last one. She shakes her head, her hazel eyes shining bright with tears. But then Abby died. It was supposed to be me, Will. Everyone was ready for that. She takes a deep breath, the weight of the world on her shoulders. It will kill my parents if I die too. It hits me like a ton of bricks. I've been wrong all along. The regimen. All this time I thought you were afraid of death, but it's not that at all. I watch her face as I keep talking. You're a dying girl with survivor's guilt. That is a complete mindfuck. How do you live with... Living is the only choice I have, Will. She snaps, standing up and glaring down at me. I stand up, staring at her, wanting to step closer and close the gap between us, wanting to shake her and get her to see. But Stella, that's not living. She turns, pulling on her face mask and bolting for the door. Stella, wait! Come on! I take a few steps after her, wishing I could just reach out and grab her hand so I can fix it. Don't go! We're supposed to be exercising, right? I'll shut up, okay? The door slams behind her. Shit. I really screwed that up. I turn my head to stare at the mat where she was just sitting, frowning at the empty space where she just was, and I realize I'm doing the one thing I've told myself this whole time I wouldn't do. I'm wanting something I can never have.
Chapter 11. Stella. I slam open the door to my room, Abby's drawings all blurring together in front of me as all the pain and the guilt I've been pushing further and further down rears its ugly head, making my knees buckle under me. I crumple onto the ground, my fingers clutching at the cold linoleum floor as I hear my mom's scream ringing in my head just like it did that morning. I was supposed to be with her that weekend in Arizona, but I was struggling so hard to breathe the night before our flight that I had to stay behind. I apologized over and over again. It was supposed to be her birthday gift. Our first trip, just the two of us. But Abby waved it off, hugging me tight and telling me that she'd be back in a few days with enough pictures and stories to make me feel like I'd been there with her all along. But she never came back. I remember hearing the phone ring downstairs. My mom sobbing. My dad knocking on my door and telling me to sit down. Something had happened. I didn't believe him. I shook my head and laughed. This was an Abby prank. It had to be. It wasn't possible. It couldn't be possible. I was the one who was supposed to die, long before all of them. Abby was practically the definition of alive. It took 3 full days for the grief to hit me. It was only when our flight back was supposed to land that I realized Abby really wasn't coming home. Then I was blindsided. I lay in bed for 2 weeks straight, ignoring my Aflo vest and my regimen. And when I got up, it wasn't just my lungs that were a mess. My parents couldn't talk to each other, couldn't even look at each other. I'd seen it coming long before it happened. I'd prepared Abby for what to do to keep them together after I was gone. But I hadn't expected to be the one doing it. I tried so hard. I planned family outings, I made dinner for them when they couldn't do anything but stare off into space. But it was all for nothing. If Abby came up, a fight always followed. If she didn't, her presence suffocated the silence. They were separated after 3 months, divorced in 6. Putting as much distance between each other as possible, leaving me straddling the in-between. But it hasn't helped. Ever since then, it's like I've been living a dream, every day focused on keeping myself alive to keep them both afloat. I make to-do lists and check them off, trying to keep myself busy, swallowing my grief and pain so my parents don't get consumed by theirs. Now, on top of all that, Will, of all people, is trying to tell me what I should be doing, as if he has any concept of what living actually means. And the worst part is that the only person I want to talk to about it is Abby. I angrily wipe away my tears with the back of my hand, pulling my phone out of my pocket and texting the only other person I know who will understand. Multipurpose lounge. Now. I think of all the drawings around my room, each one a separate trip to the hospital with Abby there to hold my hand. And now there are three trips, three whole trips without a drawing to go with them. I remember the first day I came to St. Grace's. If I hadn't been afraid before, the size of this place was enough to make a 6-year-old feel overwhelmed. The big windows, the machinery, the loud noises. I walk through the lobby, clutching Abby's hand for dear life and trying so hard to be brave. My parents talked to Barb and Dr. Hamid. Even before they knew me, they did their very best to help me feel like St. Grace's Hospital was my second home from the moment I got there. But of everyone, it was Abby who really did that. She gave me three invaluable gifts that day. The first was my stuffed panda bear, Patches, carefully hand-selected from the hospital gift shop. The second was my first of many drawings, the tornado of stars, the first piece of wallpaper I'd collect from her. And while my parents talked to Barb about the state-of-the-art facility, Abby ran off and found me the final gift of that day. The best I'd ever receive in all my years at St. Grace's. "It's impressive, for sure," my mom said, while I watched Abby trot away down the brightly colored hallway of the children's ward, disappearing around a corner. "Stella's going to be right at home here," Barbara said, giving me a warm smile. I remember clutching Patches, trying to find the courage to smile back at her. Abby rounded the corner, nearly running smack into a nurse as she sprinted back over to us, a very small, very thin, brown-haired boy wearing an oversized Colombian national team jersey trailing behind her. "Look, there are other kids here." I waved at the boy before Barb stepped in between us, colorful scrubs putting up a wall between the two of us. "Poe, you know better," she said, scolding the small boy as Abby took my hand in hers. But Abby had already set it in motion. Even from 6 feet away, Poe became my best friend, which is why he's the only person to talk me through this. I pace back and forth, the lounge a blur in front of me. I try to focus on the fish tank or the TV or the refrigerator humming in the corner, but I'm still livid over my fight with Will.
"You knew he had boundary issues,"
Poe says from behind me, watching me intently from the edge of the love seat.
"For what it's worth, I don't think he meant to hurt you."
I spin around to face him, clutching at the counter of the kitchenette. When he said Abby and dead, my voice cracks and I dig my fingers into the cool marble of the counter. Like it was no big deal, I just... Poe shakes his head, his eyes sad. "I should have been with her, Poe," I choke out, wiping my eyes with the back of my hand. "She was always there, to stand by me when I needed her. And I wasn't there when she needed me most."
"Don't. Not again. It's not your fault. She'd tell you it's not your fault."
"Was she in pain? What if she was scared?" I gasp, the air catching in my chest. I keep seeing my sister plummeting down, like she did in the GoPro video and a million times before, bungee jumping and cliff diving with reckless abandon. Only,
This time there's no wild whoop of joy and excitement. She hits the water and doesn't resurface. She wasn't supposed to die. She was supposed to be the one to live. Hey, stop. Look at me. I stare at him, tears pouring from my eyes. You have to stop, he says, his fingers clutching the armrest of the couch, his knuckles turning white. You can't know. You just can't. You'll drive yourself crazy. I take a deep breath, shaking my head. He stands up, stepping toward me and groaning in frustration. This disease is a fucking prison. I want to hug you. I sniff, nodding in agreement. Pretend I did, okay? He says. I see he's blinking back tears, too. And know that I love you more than food, more than the Colombian national team. I crack a smile, nodding. I love you too, Poe. He pretends to blow me a kiss without actually breathing my way. I slump down onto the mint-green love seat sitting vacant across from Poe's, immediately gasping in pain as my vision doubles. I sit bolt upright and clutch at my side, my G-tube burning like absolute fire. Poe's face turns white. Stella, is everything okay? My G-tube, I say, the pain subsiding. I sit up, shaking my head and gasping for breath. I'm fine. I'm fine. I take a deep breath and lift my shirt and see that the infection has only gotten way worse, the skin red and puffy, the G-tube and the area around it oozing. My eyes widen in surprise. It's only been 8 days here. How have I not noticed how bad it's gotten? Poe winces, shaking his head. Let's get you back to your room. Now. 15 minutes later, Dr. Hamid gently touches the infected skin around my G-tube, and I grimace as pain radiates across my stomach and chest. She takes her hand away, shaking her head as she pulls her gloves off and carefully puts them in a trash can by the door. We need to take care of this. It's too far gone. We have to excoriate the skin and replace your G-tube to purge the infection. I immediately feel woozy, my insides turning cold. It's the words I've been afraid of since it first started looking infected. I put my shirt back down, trying not to let the fabric rub against the area. But, she cuts me off. No buts. It has to be done. We are risking sepsis here. If this gets any worse, the infection can get into your bloodstream. We're both silent, knowing how big the risk is here. If I get sepsis, I'll definitely die. But if I get put under for surgery, my lungs might not be strong enough to pull me through to the other side. She sits down next to me, bumping my shoulder and smiling at me. It'll be okay. You don't know that, I say, swallowing nervously. She nods, her face thoughtful. You're right, I don't. She takes a deep breath, meeting my anxious gaze. It's risky. I won't say it's not. But sepsis is a far bigger and far more likely monster. Fear creeps up my neck and wraps itself around my entire body. But she's right. Dr. Hamid picks up the panda sitting next to me, looking at it and smiling faintly. You're a fighter, Stella. You always have been. Holding out the bear to me, she looks into my eyes. Tomorrow morning, then? I reach out, taking the panda, nodding. Tomorrow morning. I'm going to call your parents and let them know, she says, and I freeze, a wave of dread hitting me. Can you give it a few minutes so I can break the news to them? It'll be easier coming from me.
She nods, giving my shoulder a tight squeeze before leaving. I lie back, clinging to patches, anxiety filling me as I think about the calls I have to make. I keep hearing my mom in the cafeteria, her voice weaving circles around my head. I don't know what I'd do without you. I don't know what I'd do without you. I don't know what I'd do without you. I hear a noise outside my door and turn my head to see an envelope sliding underneath. I watch the light trickling in from under the door as a pair of feet stand there for a moment, before slowly turning and walking away. I stand carefully and bend down to pick up the envelope. Opening it, I pull out a cartoon drawing, the colors sad and dull. It's a picture of a frowning Will, a wilted bouquet of flowers in his hand, a bubble caption underneath it reading, "Sorry." I lie back down on my bed, holding the drawing to my chest and closing my eyes tightly. Dr. Hamid said I was a fighter. But I really don't know that I am anymore.
Chapter 12. Will. I messed up bad. I know that. I sneak out of our wing and around the east lobby of the hospital after dropping off the drawing, my phone clutched in my hand as I wait for something. A text, a FaceTime call, anything. She must have seen the drawing by now, right? Her light was on, but it's been radio silent since our fight. What should I do? She won't even talk to me, I text Jason, grimacing at myself. I can see him getting a real kick over me hung up on someone enough to ask his advice. Just give her some time, man, he replies. I sigh loudly, frustrated. Time. All this waiting is agony. I plop down on a bench, watching people pass by as they go through the sliding doors of the hospital. Young kids, nervously clutching the hands of their parents. Nurses, rubbing their eyes sleepily as they finally get to leave. Visitors, eagerly pulling on their jackets as they head home for the night. For the first time in a few days, I wish I were one of them. My stomach growls noisily, and I decide to head to the cafeteria to distract myself with some food. Walking toward the elevator, I freeze when I hear a familiar voice pouring out of a room nearby. No envíe dinero, no puede pagarlo, the voice says, the tone somber, sad. Dinero. Money. I took 2 years of Spanish in high school and can say only a handful of phrases, but I recognize that word. I peek my head inside to see it's a chapel, with big stained glass windows and classic wooden pews. The old churchy look is so different from the rest of the hospital's modern, sleek design. My eyes land on Poe, sitting in the front row, his elbows resting on his knees as he talks to someone over FaceTime. Yo también te extraño, he says. Lo sé. Te amo, mamá. He hangs up the phone, putting his head in his hands. I pull the heavy door open a bit wider, the hinges creaking loudly as I do. He turns around in surprise. The chapel? I ask, my voice echoing too loud off the walls of the wide space as I make my way down the aisle toward him. He looks around, smiling faintly. My mom likes to see me in here. I'm Catholic, but she's Catholic. He sighs, leaning his head against the pew. I haven't seen her in 2 years. She wants me to come visit her. My eyes widen in surprise and I sit down across the aisle a safe distance away. That's a really long time. You haven't seen your mom in 2 years? What did she do to you? He shakes his head, his dark eyes filled with sadness. It's not like that. They got deported back to Colombia, but I was born here, and they didn't want to take me away from my doctors. I'm a ward of the state until I'm 18. Shit. I can't even imagine what that was like. How could they deport the parents of someone with CF, the parents of someone terminal? That's fucked up, I say. Poe nods. I miss them. So much. I frown, running my fingers through my hair. Poe, you have to go. You have to visit them. He sighs, fixing his eyes on the large wooden cross sitting behind the pulpit, and I remember what I overheard. Dinero. It's pricey. She wants to send money, but she can't really afford it, and I'm certainly not going to take food off her table. Listen, if it's money, I can help. Seriously, I'm not trying to be a privileged dick, but it's not an issue. But before I could even finish, I know it's a no-go. Come on, stop. He turns his head to give me a look before his face softens. I'll figure it out. A silence falls over us, the quiet, open air of the big room making my ears ring. This isn't just about money. Besides, I know more than anyone that money can't fix everything. Maybe someday my mom will catch on. Thanks, though, Poe says finally, smiling at me. I mean it. I nod as we fall silent again. How is it fair that my mom can hover over me while someone else has his just ripped away from him? Here I am, counting down to 18, while Poe is trying to slow time down, wishing for more of it. More time. For me, it was easy to give up. It was easy to fight my treatments and focus on the time I do have. Stop working so damn hard for just a few seconds more. But Stella and Poe are making me want every second more that I can get. And that terrifies me more than anything else. That evening, I lie on my bed, staring up at the ceiling as I do my nebulizer treatment without Stella. Anything? Jason texts me, which doesn't help since the answer is a resounding no. Still nothing from her. Not even a note. But I can't stop thinking about her. And the longer she's silent, the worse it gets. I can't stop thinking about what it would be like to be close to her, to reach out and actually touch her, to make her feel better after I screwed up. I can feel something reaching from deep in my chest, in the tips of my fingers and the pit of my stomach, reaching out to feel the smooth skin of her arm, the raised scars I'm sure are on her body. But I'll never be able to. The distance between us will never go away or change. 6 feet forever. My phone rings and I grab it, hopeful, but it's just a notification from Twitter. I throw my phone down on my bed, frustrated. What the hell, Stella? She can't stay mad forever. Can she? I need to make this right. I switch off the nebulizer and throw my legs over the bed, sliding into my shoes and peering into the hallway to make sure the coast is clear. I see Julie sliding into a room farther down the hall with an IV drip, and I quickly slip out of my room, knowing I have time. Walking quietly down the hallway, I pass the empty nurse's station and freeze in front of her door, hearing music softly playing on the other side. She's in there. Taking a deep breath, I knock, the sound of my knuckles reverberating off the worn wood. I hear the music shut off, and then her footsteps as she comes closer and closer, stopping in front of the door, hesitating. Finally, it opens, her hazel eyes making my heart pound heavily in my chest. It's so good to see her. You're here, I say softly. I'm here, she says coolly, leaning against the doorframe and acting like she didn't just ignore me for the whole day. I got your cartoon. You're forgiven. Back up. I quickly step all the way back to the far wall, putting the 6 frustrating feet between us. We stare at each other, and she blinks, looking away to check the hall for nurses before looking down at the tile floor. You missed our treatment. She looks impressed that I actually remembered, but stays silent. I notice her eyes are red, like she's been crying, and I don't think it's from what I said. What's going on? She takes a deep breath, and when she speaks, I can hear the nerves lacing her words. The skin around my G-tube is pretty badly infected. Dr. Hamid's worried about sepsis. She's going to purge my infected skin and replace my G-tube in the morning. When I look in her eyes, I see it's way more than nerves. She's afraid. I want to reach out and take her hand in mine. I want to tell her that everything will be okay and that this shouldn't be a bad one. I'm going under general. What? General anesthesia? With her lungs at 35%? Is Dr. Hamid out of her mind? I grip the railing on the wall to keep myself in place. Shit. Are your lungs up for that? We stare at each other for a moment, the open air between us feeling like miles and miles. She looks away, ignoring the question. Remember to take your bedtime meds and then set up your G-tube feeding for the night, okay? Without giving me time to respond, she closes the door. I walk slowly to it, reaching out to lay my hand flat against it, knowing she's on the other side. I take a deep breath, resting my head on the door, my voice barely a whisper. It's going to be okay, Stella. My fingers land on a sign hanging on her door. I look up, reading it. Nothing to eat or drink after midnight. Surgery 6 a.m. I pull my hand away before I get busted by one of the nurses and walk down the hallway to my room, plopping down on my bed. Stella is normally so in control. Why is this time so different? Is it because of her parents? Because of how low her lung function is? I roll over on my side, my eyes landing on my own lung drawing, making me remember the drawing in her room. Abby. Of course, that's why she's so freaked out. This is her first surgery without Abby. I still need to make things right. An idea pops into my head and I sit bolt upright. Grabbing my phone from my pocket, I set an alarm for 5 a.m. for the first time maybe ever. Then I take my box of art supplies off my shelf and get planning.
Chapter 13. Stella. I hold Patches close to my chest and look from my mom to my dad as they sit on either side of me. Both of them shoot me thin-lipped smiles that don't reach their eyes as they avoid each other's gazes. I look over at the picture of all of us pinned to the back of my door, wishing I could have those parents back, the ones who always told me everything would be okay. Taking a deep breath, I suppress a cough while my dad tries to make some small talk. He holds up the pink calendar they sent around to all the rooms with the daily specials down at the cafeteria.
I think there's going to be cream of broccoli soup tonight for dinner. Your favorite, Stell.
She probably won't be up for eating right after the surgery, Tom. My mom snaps at him, his face falling at her words. I try to sound enthusiastic. If I'm up for it tonight, I'll definitely get some. There's a knock on the door, and an orderly walks in, wearing a surgical cap and a pair of blue latex gloves. My parents both stand up, my dad reaching out to take my hand. It takes everything in me to steady it. See you in a few, honey. My mom says, as both of them give me big hugs, which linger a little too long. I wince as my G-tube rubs up against them, but I hold on tight, not wanting them to let go. The orderly pulls up the railings on the sides of my gurney, locking them in place with a click. I stare at Abby's drawing as they roll me out, the healthy lungs calling to me. I wish more than anything she were here with me now, holding my hand, singing the song. The orderly rolls me down the hallway, my parents' faces fading as they get farther and farther away, and we get into the elevator at the end of the hall. As the doors slide shut, the orderly smiles at me. I try to smile back, but my mouth refuses to make the shape. I clutch at the sheets, my fingers interlacing with the fabric. The door dings open, the familiar hallways whiz by, everything seeming too bright, too whitewashed to make out specifics. We go through the heavy double doors into the pre-op area, and then into a room slightly down the hallway. The orderly pushes the gurney into place.
"Need anything before I head out?"
he asks. I shake my head, trying to take a deep breath as he leaves, the room becoming completely silent except for the steady beeping of my monitors. I stare at the ceiling, trying to push away the growing panic eating away at my insides. I did everything right. I was careful and put on the Fusidin. I took my medication at the scheduled times, and I'm still lying here about to go into surgery anyway. All of my obsessing over my regimen for nothing. I think I get it now. Why Will would go on to the roof. I'd do anything to get up from the gurney and run far, far away. To Cabo, to Vatican City to see the Sistine Chapel. to all the things I have avoided out of fear of getting sicker, only to find myself lying here anyway, about to go into another surgery I might not come out of. My fingers wrap around the railings clicked into place on either side of me, my knuckles turning white as I tighten my grip on them, willing myself to be a fighter like Dr. Hamid said yesterday. If I want to do those things, I need more time. I have to fight for it. The door slowly opens, and a tall, thin person ducks inside. He's wearing the same green surgeon scrubs, face mask, and blue gloves that the pre-op nurses wear, but his wavy brown hair is peeking out from under a clear surgical cap. His eyes find mine, and I let go of the railings in surprise. "What are you doing here?" I whisper, watching as Will sits down in a chair beside me, scooting it back to make sure he's a safe distance away.
"It's your first surgery without Abby," he says in explanation, a new expression I don't quite recognize filling his blue eyes.
It's not mocking or jokey. It's totally and completely open, almost earnest. I swallow hard, trying to stop the emotions that come bubbling up, tears clouding my eyes. "How did you know that?"
"I've seen all your movies," he says, his eyes crinkling at the corners as he smiles at me. "You might say I'm a fan."
"All of them? Even that embarrassing one from when I was 12?
"I might mess this up,"
he says, clearing his throat as he pulls a sheet of paper from his pocket. He starts to sing, softly.
"I love you, a bushel and a peck."
"Go away. I'm being stupid," I blubber as I wipe the tears away with the back of my hand, shaking my head.
"A bushel and a peck and a hug around the neck."
Abby's song. He's singing Abby's song. The tears start rolling down my face faster than I can catch them as I watch his deep blue eyes, focused on reading every lyric off that crumpled piece of paper. I feel like my heart might burst. I'm feeling so many things at once. "My gran used to sing us that song. I never loved it, but Abby did." He laughs, shaking his head.
"I had to Google it. Man, it is old."
I laugh with him, nodding. "I know. What the hell is a
barrel and a heap?"
we say at the same time, the both of us laughing, his eyes meeting mine and making my heart dance inside my chest, the heart monitor just next to him beeping faster and faster. He leans forward, ever so slightly, just barely in the danger zone, but enough to push away the pain of the G-tube.
"You're going to be just fine, Stella."
His voice is deep, soft. I know in that moment, even though it could not be more ridiculous, that if I die in there, I won't die without falling in love. "Promise?" I ask. He nods and stretches his arm out, holding up a gloved pinky across the distance. I take it, and we pinky promise. The smallest contact, but the first time we've ever touched. And right now, that doesn't scare me. My head snaps in the direction of the door as the sound of footsteps comes closer and closer. Dr. Hamid appears, a surgical nurse pushing through the door with her.
"Ready to get this show on the road?"
she says, shooting me a thumbs up. My head whips around to the chair where Will was sitting, fear gripping my chest. It's empty. And then I see him, behind the gray curtain, his back pressed up against the wall. He holds his finger to his mouth and pulls his face mask off to smile at me. I smile back, and as I look at him, I start to believe what he said.
I'm going to be fine. A few minutes later, I'm lying on the operating table, the room dim except for the blinding light directly above my head.
All right, Stella. You know what to do, a voice says, holding up a mask in a blue-gloved hand.
My heart begins pounding nervously, and I turn my head to face them, meeting their dark eyes as they put the mask over my nose and mouth. When I wake up, it will all be over. 10, I say, looking past the anesthesiologist to the operating room wall, my eyes landing on a shape that's oddly familiar. Abby's lung drawing. How? But I know, of course. Will. He snuck it into the operating room. A single tear falls from my eye, and I keep counting. 9. 8. The flowers all start to swim together, the blues and the pinks and the whites all twisting and turning and blurring together, the colors coming off the page and reaching toward me. 7. 6. 5. The night sky suddenly comes to life, swimming past the flowers, the stars filling the air around me. They twinkle and dance above my head, close enough for me to reach out and touch them. I hear a voice humming somewhere in the distance, a bushel and a peck. 4. 3. The edges of my vision start going black, my world going darker and darker. I focus on a single star, a single point of light, getting brighter and warmer and more overwhelming. The humming stops, and I hear a voice, far off and muddled. Abby. Oh my God, it's Abby's voice. Back. Don't. 2, I whisper, not sure if it's in my head or out loud. And then I see her. I see Abby, right there in front of me, blurry at first, and then as clear as day. My dad's curly hair and her larger-than-life smile and her hazel eyes identical to my own. More time. She's pushing me away from the light. 1. Darkness.
Chapter 14. Will. I quietly push open the door, looking both ways before sneaking out of the pre-op area and almost running smack into a nurse. I quickly look away and put my face mask up to disguise myself as she heads inside. I take a few quick steps and hide behind the wall next to the stairwell, noticing a man and woman sitting on opposite sides of the empty waiting room. Squinting, I look from one to the other. I know them from somewhere.
"Could I ask you a question?"
the man says, and the woman looks up to meet his eyes, her jaw tightening. She looks like an older Stella. Those same full lips, the same thick eyebrows, the same expressive eyes. Stella's parents. She nods just once, looking wary. You can practically cut the tension with a knife. I know I should leave. I know I should open the stairwell door and get back before I get in trouble. But something makes me stay.
The tile in my bathroom is, purple. What color bath mat do I...
Black, she says, putting her head back down and looking at her hands, her hair falling in front of her face. There's a moment of silence, and I hear the door in the hallway quietly open, barbs sliding through. Neither of them notices her come in. Stella's dad clears his throat.
And the towels?
She throws up her hands, exasperated.
It doesn't matter, Tom. It mattered when we painted the office. You said the rug.
Our daughter's in surgery, and you want to talk about towels? She snaps, her face livid. I've never seen Barb look so displeased. She crosses her arms, standing up a little straighter as she watches their back and forth.
I just want to talk. Her dad says softly, about anything.
Oh my God, you're killing me. Stop. Her voice trails off as they both look over to see Barb,
her face steadily growing angrier and angrier until it has the same look that she gives us when we get in trouble. She takes a deep breath, pulling all the air from the room. "I can't imagine what you've been through losing Abby," she says, her voice deathly serious. "But Stella?" She points at the pre-op doors, where somewhere in the distance, Stella is lying on a table, about to be operated on. "Stella is fighting for her life in there, and she's doing it for you." They both look away, ashamed. "You can't be friends. At least be adults." Barbara fires at them, her voice filled with frustration. "Dang, Barb. Take it to church." Stella's mom shakes her head. "I can't be around him. I look at his face and I see Abby." Her dad looks up quickly, barely taking in her face before he looks away again. "I see Stella when I look at you." "You are their parents. Did you forget that part of the deal? Did you know that when she found out about the surgery, she insisted on telling you herself because she was so afraid of how you'd take it?" Barb says, looking up. "God, no wonder Stella was so obsessive about staying alive. These people lost their child, and then they lost each other. If she died, they'd probably lose their minds." "My dad left before I got sicker and sicker, before the CF could take a toll on my body. He couldn't handle a sick child. He definitely couldn't handle a dead one. But two?" I watch as her parents finally look at each other, really look at each other, a teary silence settling over them. "Stella's been taking care of all of us. Her mom, her dad, me. I keep counting down to 18, to being an adult, holding the reins. Maybe it's time I actually acted like it. Maybe it's time I took care of myself." I blink, looking over to Barb, her eyes widening at the same time as mine. Uh-oh, I'm like a deer caught in the headlights, unsure if I should bolt or just get what's coming to me. I hesitate for too long, and she storms over, grabbing my arm and pulling me down the hall to the elevator. "Oh, hell no!" I stay silent as the elevator doors slide open, and she drags me inside. She presses the button for the third floor, again and again and again, shaking her head. I can feel the anger literally radiating off her. "Look, Barb, I know you're mad, but she was scared. I just had to see her." The doors slide shut, and she spins around to look at me, her face like thunder. "You could kill her, Will. You could ruin any chance she has for new lungs. She's in more danger under the anesthesia than she is with me," I fire back. "Wrong!" Barb shouts as the elevator slows to a stop, the doors opening. She storms out and I follow behind her, calling after her. "What is your deal, Barb?" "Trevor Vaughn and Amy Presley, young CFers, just like you and Stella," Barb says, turning on her heel to face me. "Amy came in with bisipatia." Her eyes are serious, so I close my mouth before I make one of my usual comments and let her keep talking. "I was young, about Julie's age, new at this, new at life." She looks past me, staring into a different time. "Trevor and Amy were in love. We all knew the rules, no contact, 6 feet apart. And I," she points to herself, "I let them break the rules because I wanted them to be happy." "Let me guess, they both died?" I ask, knowing the ending long before she tells it to me. "Yes," she says, looking me dead in the eyes, fighting back tears. "Trevor contracted bisipatia from Amy. Amy lived for another decade. But Trevor? He got ripped off the top of the transplant list and lived only 2 more years after the bacteria tanked his lung function." Shit. I swallow, looking from her to Stella's room, just past the nurse's station. The list of things that can happen to us CFers, the ghost stories we're told, is pretty much endless. But hearing Barb talk about Trevor and Amy, it doesn't feel like a ghost story at all. "It was on my watch, Will," she says, pointing at herself and shaking her head adamantly. "I'll be damned if it's gonna happen again." With that, she turns and walks away, leaving me speechless. I look over to see Poe standing in his doorway, his expression unreadable. He heard the whole thing. He opens his mouth to say something, but I hold up my hand, cutting him off. I make a beeline for my room, closing the door loudly behind me.
I grab my laptop from my nightstand and sit down on the bed. My fingers hover over the keyboard, and then I search it. I search B. Sapatia. Words jump out at me. Contamination. Risk. Infection. With just a cough, with just a single touch, I could ruin her entire life. I could ruin any chance she has for new lungs. I could hurt Stella. I knew it, I guess. But I didn't really see it. The thought of that makes every bone in my body ache. Worse than surgeries or infections, or waking up on a bad morning barely able to breathe. Even worse than the pain of being in the same room as her and not being able to touch her. Death. That's what I am. That's what I am to Stella. The only thing worse than not being able to be with her or be around her would be living in a world that she didn't exist in at all. Especially if it's my fault.
Chapter 15. Stella.
Time to wake up, honey, a voice says, somewhere far in the distance.
It's my mom's voice, closer now, from right beside me. I take a deep breath, the world swinging into focus, my head foggy. I blink as her face comes into view, my dad standing beside her.
I'm alive. I made it.
There's my sleeping beauty, she says, and I rub my eyes groggily. I know I just woke up, but I am exhausted.
How do you feel?
My dad asks, and I respond with a sleepy groan, smiling at the both of them. There's a knock on the door, and Julie pushes it open, coming in with a wheelchair to take me down to my room. And my bed, thank goodness. I swing my hand into the air, holding up my thumb hitchhiker style, and shout out, "Can I get a ride?" Julie laughs, and my dad helps me get off the gurney and into the wheelchair. Whatever pain meds I'm on right now are strong. I can't feel my face, let alone the pain from my G-tube.
"We'll stop by later to check in on you,"
my dad says, and I shoot them both a thumbs up, freezing. Wait. Wheel. We'll stop by later to check in on you? Did I wake up in an alternate universe? I grumble, rubbing my eyes and squinting at them. My mom smiles and strokes my hair comfortingly as she looks over at my dad.
You're our daughter, Stella. Always have been, always will be.
These pain meds are strong. I open my mouth to say something, but I'm too stunned and exhausted to string a sentence together. I just nod, my head swinging wildly up and down.
"Go get some sleep, sweetie," my mom says, planting a kiss on my forehead.
Julie takes me down the hall and into the elevator. It's almost impossible to keep my eyes open, my eyelids feeling heavier than a sack of potatoes.
"Phew, Jules, I am pooped," I slur, shooting her a side eye and seeing her pregnant belly at eye level just over my shoulder.
The elevator doors open and she wheels me into my room, locking the tires on the wheelchair.
"The skin and tube look much better. You'll be up and around by this afternoon. No crunches, though."
I struggle as she helps me stand slowly and get into bed, my legs and arms feeling like lead weights. She fixes my pillows and tucks me in gently, pulling the covers up over my body.
"You get to hold your own baby," I say, sighing sleepily, sadly.
Julie meets my gaze. She sits down on the edge of my bed, letting out a long sigh.
"I'm going to need help, Stella. It's just me."
She smiles at me, her blue eyes warm.
"Can't think of anyone I would trust more."
I reach out, trying to be as gentle as possible as my exhausted hand pats her stomach, Once. Twice. Nailed it. I give her a big grin. I'm going to be the best aunt ever. Aunt Stella. Me. An aunt? I slump down sleepily, the surgery and the pain meds finally overtaking me. She kisses me on the forehead and leaves, the door gently closing behind her. I sink into my pillow, curling up and pulling my panda closer. I look over at my side table, my eyes slowly wait. I sit up, grabbing a folded paper box sitting there, tied with a red ribbon. I pull the ribbon and the box unfurls into a handmade, colorful, pop-up bouquet of flowers, the same purple lilacs and pink hydrangeas and white wildflowers as in Abby's drawing suddenly brought to life. Will. I smile, putting it gently back down as I fumble around for my phone. I grab it, and it takes everything in me to focus on the screen as I scroll through to Will's number. I hit dial, listening to it ring, my eyes closing as it goes to voicemail. I jump at the beep, my voice slurred when I start speaking. It's me, Stella. Don't call me, okay? 'Cause I just had surgery and I'm so tired, but call me when you get this. But no, don't. Okay, 'cause if I hear your sexy voice, I won't be able to sleep. Yeah, so call me, okay? I fumble with the phone, pressing the end button. I curl up, pulling my blankets closer to my body and grabbing my panda again. I'm still staring at the flowers when I finally drift off to sleep. My phone starts chirping, pulling me out of my deep post-surgery sleep. I roll over, my eyes less heavy as they open, and see that Poe is calling me on FaceTime. Fumbling with the screen, I finally press the green button and his face appears. You're alive. I grin, rubbing my eyes and sitting up. I'm still sleepy, but the drugs have worn off enough that my head doesn't feel like a paperweight. Hey, I'm alive, I say, my eyes widening as they land on the beautiful bouquet of flowers still on my side table. The tube's looking good. Will, I vaguely remember opening the bouquet. I quickly double-check my text messages. 2 from my mom, 3 from Camila, 1 from Maya, 4 from my dad, all checking in to see how I'm feeling. There are none from Will. My heart falls about 20 stories. Have you talked to Will? I ask, frowning. Nope, Poe says, shaking his head. He looks like he wants to say something else, but he doesn't. I take a deep breath, coughing, my side aching where the skin infection was. Ow. I stretch. The pain is definitely there, but manageable. I have a message on Instagram, and I swipe to see that it's a reply from Michael that I got while I was sleeping. He messaged me last night to see how Poe was doing, asking about his bronchitis, and most surprisingly, if he was going to visit his parents in Colombia. I had no idea he was even considering it. We talked back and forth for close to an hour about how happy he is that I'm here with Poe at the hospital, about how great Poe is, how he doesn't understand what went wrong. He really cares about him. Michael DM'd me, I say, glancing up to see Poe's reaction to my words as I toggle back onto FaceTime. What? He asks, surprised. Why? Asking if you're okay. Poe's expression is unreadable, his dark eyes serious. He's sweet. Really seems to love you. He rolls his eyes. In my business again, clearly you've fully recovered. Poe is missing out on love because he's afraid. Afraid to go the distance. Afraid to fully let someone into all the crap we have to live with. I know what it's like to have that fear. But that fear didn't stop the scary shit from happening. I don't want it anymore. I'm just saying, I say, shrugging casually, even though my words are serious. He doesn't care that you're sick. Michael doesn't care that Poe has CF. He cares that he can't be there for Poe. When you have CF, you don't know how much time you have left. But honestly, you don't know how much time the ones you love have left either. My gaze travels to the pop-up bouquet. And what's this about visiting your family? You're definitely going, right?
Call me when you're off the drugs, he says, glaring at me and hanging up.
I send a quick text to both my parents, telling them to head home and get some rest, since it's already late afternoon and I need to sleep a bit longer. They've been stuck here for hours, and I don't want them waiting for me to wake up when they need to take care of themselves. They both object, though, and a few minutes later there's a knock on my door, the two of them, together, popping their heads in to look at me. I remember vaguely the "we" from when I first woke up, the two of them a united front for the first time since Abby's death. How are you feeling? My mom asks, smiling at me and kissing my forehead. I sit up, shaking my head. Listen, you two should really go. You've been here.
We're your parents, Stell. Even though we aren't together, we are still here for you, my dad says, taking my hand and squeezing it. You always come first. And these past few months, we definitely haven't showed that.
These past few months have been tough on all of us, my mom says, sharing a look of understanding with him. But it's not on you to make us feel better, okay? We're your parents, honey. More than anything, we want you to be happy, Stella. I nod. Never in a million years would I have expected this.
By the way, my dad says, plunking down in the chair next to my bed. The soup is great. Say what you want about cafeteria food, but they make a mean broccoli cheddar.
My mom and I look at each other, smiles giving way to deep belly laughs that I have to suppress so my new G-tube doesn't hurt. The sadness stays put, but I feel an ounce of the weight on my shoulders slowly drift away, and I inhale, breathing a little easier than I have in a long time. Maybe this surgery wasn't the worst thing after all. I doze off for a little longer after my parents leave, sleeping off the last bit of the fogginess, and when I wake up an hour later, I'm fully out of the anesthesia haze. I slowly sit up, stretching, the pain from my surgery pulling at my side and chest. The pain meds are wearing off, too. I lift up my shirt to take a look. My skin is still raw and sore from surgery, but the area around my G-tube already looks about a million times better. My eyes fall on the pop-up bouquet, and I grin excitedly, carefully standing up and taking a deep breath. The air struggles in and out of my lungs, and I take my portable oxygen off my bedside table, putting the nose cannula in and turning it on to give them a hand. I reply to Maya and Camila to let them know I'm awake and not to worry. I'm as good as new, or at least back to 35%. I still have to dish to them about what just happened with my parents, but they're getting on a boat, and I have somewhere I need to be, too. Getting changed, I move slowly and carefully, pulling on a pair of leggings and a tie-dye t-shirt that Abby got me when she went to the Grand Canyon. I catch a look at myself in the mirror, the dark circles under my eyes looking deeper than they've been in months. I brush my hair quickly and put it into a neat ponytail, frowning when it doesn't look as good as I hoped it would. I put it back down, nodding in contentment at my reflection as my hair falls gently around my shoulders. Grabbing my makeup bag from the bottom of my drawer, I put on some mascara and lip gloss, smiling at the idea of Will seeing me not just alive, but with makeup